Whether your idea of good food is sprouted grains or a bacon burger, you've probably spent at least a little time thinking about what you eat and why you eat it. If you haven't, well, our guest this hour has thought a lot about the ethics of food and choosing food to eat. Two legs or four legs, animal, vegetable, or mineral, there's plenty to consider. Marissa Landrigan is the author of The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food. Marissa teaches writing at the University of Pittsburgh-Johnstown, where she's an assistant professor. Her essays have been published in the likes of The Atlantic and Salon. Marissa, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeffrey.
Well, from page one, it seems like a strong stomach and a resistant gag reflex are required. You go into some detail in the slaughterhouse right up front here.
That's true. I really found that the closer you get to the source of your food, the more you have to work to make sure that you can really stomach what it is you're looking at. And it's really a journey and a process to come to terms with what that looks like. But I think that I've found that when you feel like you're in an ethical situation, when you feel like you're participating in a food system that's ethical and sustainable, it's not quite as difficult to look at those kinds of things.
Did you think you'd be horrified visiting a slaughterhouse?
I absolutely expected to be. I was anticipating that it was relatively gruesome. You know, way back when I became a vegetarian and I saw the way that animals were processed in an industrial slaughterhouse, I was horrified by that. But I really found that in this small-scale, locally owned, humane slaughterhouse, the things felt a lot different, and it didn't horrify me in the way that I sort of anticipated it might.
I was a little surprised. I mean, on this small operation, they sort of knew the animals and had a sense of who they were as individual creatures.
Yes, absolutely. They really sort of took the time. They processed only one animal at a time. So from start to finish, there was only one animal at a time in the slaughterhouse. On the slaughterhouse floor, there was hanging a sign that said, "We honor these animals, for by their death we gain life." And so it really felt like all the people who were participating in the slaughter sort of understood the sacrifice that was being made there.
Okay, we can talk more about slaughterhouses and other food processing operations later on. I want to come back to the beginnings of your story. I mean, it sounds like food played a very central role in your family culture growing up.
Yes, absolutely. I grew up in an Italian-American family. My mother's side of the family is all Italian, and that meant that food was everything to us. Cooking and eating together were great sort of family rituals, and food was really a place where we all came together to sort of share in our family heritage and history, and also a place where we all connected with each other.
How authentic was the food made in the family kitchen then? I mean, how authentic was it? How far into the material did you go?
Well, pretty far, though it was sort of an interesting blend of the Italian part and the American part. We really had these group day-long cooking fests. We made our own pasta from scratch. We made our own ravioli and tortellini. We made our own pasta sauce. And so we really were making these sort of authentic Italian recipes. But we also lived in the suburbs of New England, and so we ate and cooked those things out of pretty stereotypical suburban ingredients. We shopped at the bulk store Costco. We bought canned tomato products for the sauce that we were making.
And, shocking.
You know, massive packages of ground beef for our meatballs.
It was a funny thing in here. The first time you saw a drying rack and somebody put clothes on it, was that a surprise to you?
I honestly believed that those wooden folded racks were used for drying pasta because that's what we used it for in my house.
So if food was that important to your family growing up, I mean, was this not a family that ever went to the burger joints?
Oh, no, we absolutely did. We went out to eat often. My mom tried as much as possible to keep us from eating too much fast food. It was important to her that we ate as healthy and balanced a diet as possible. But as I said, we were also just a pretty typical suburban American family taking advantage of the speed and convenience of so much of our modern food system.
Now, when things were going on heavy duty in the family kitchen, describe your role there, if any.
Well, I am an introvert by nature, a very shy one, too, and so I tended to actually hide out if I could at all possible. The kitchen was a crowded space, and crowds tended to make me nervous, and so I would very often crawl under the kitchen table and just bring myself a stack of books in there and read and watch and sort of be surrounded by the chaos of my family. So unfortunately, though there was a lot of this authentic cooking going on, I didn't ever really learn how to cook for myself until many, many years later.
So really you didn't know much about the whole cooking process. You just sort of been left alone.
Yes, exactly. I got to be the sort of outside observer, and I got to help out here and there. I often helped carry the dried pasta over to the drying rack, but that was about the extent of it. It was really my mother, my grandmother, my grandfather who were sort of at the heart of the cooking operation.
All right, so a real chance to differentiate yourself, not just for you, but for any people, comes in college. How radical did you get in your food approaches in college? Radical in general, I guess.
I like to think that I got pretty radical, though, of course, with time and on hindsight, I see now that my food choices were actually radical, but still very much within this sort of industrial food system. So I was sort of becoming more of a progressive person, taking lots of classes that were opening my eyes to injustices that I hadn't been aware of earlier. And one of those was discovering the factory farming system and the system of industrially produced agriculture. And that I just couldn't stomach. The first time I saw an undercover video from PETA, I decided that I was done eating meat, and I boycotted it from there on out. Of course, I was boycotting meat and becoming a vegetarian while eating in my college dining hall, so my options as far as all that goes were fairly limited.
The PETA film you mentioned, was that Meet Your Meat?
That's exactly right.
Okay, that's quite an impact it had on you. We'll talk more about the turn toward vegetarianism, and then a different turn years later. The book is called The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat. It is not a cookbook. It is, however, called A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food, and it's an interesting journey through the ways in which we decide what we're going to eat and what those decisions have upon other creatures, humans included. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Marissa Landrigan and you in a minute 20. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the ethics of eating today, or more accurately, the ethics of choosing what to eat, because let's face it, if we are eating meat, we are eating things that did once live, so that affects those creatures. Anything we do in the food industry, anything that we consume is going to affect the activities of some other creature, often humans, and the ways in which they are treated as well on the procuring of our food. Marissa Landrigan considers all of this in her book, The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat. I want to point out again, it is not a cookbook. There are no recipes in here. The subtitle is A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about the ethics of what we choose to eat. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone. Your thoughts are welcome by email as well at jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking about the PETA film you saw in college, Meet Your Meat, which gets you and gets us now to a point of realization for many people. Meat once lived. Do we generally choose not to think too hard about that, you find?
Yes, absolutely. I had spent so much of my meat-eating years actively sort of trying to avoid acknowledging the fact that my food had once been a living animal. I remember very clearly once I was at a steakhouse with my family, and the steakhouse had a cattle head mounted on the wall. And I said something to my dad like, why would anyone want to look at the head of a cow while they're eating the steak? And he simply shrugged and said, well, that's what it is. And that was the sort of mentality that I really had gone into college with, was that I wanted to ignore the fact that I was eating an animal. And seeing the way that animals were treated in the process of being converted into food in that PETA video was just too much for me to stomach.
No, I don't understand again. Were you already a vegetarian by the time you saw the video, or did that convince you?
That was, the PETA video was the thing that actually convinced me. It was seeing the way that animals were slaughtered so that they could become food. And I said to myself, I can't participate in that kind of inhumane system.
So you include the shaving of your head, Marissa, as a sign of the completeness of your conversion. Talk about what you've done with yourself physically.
Yes, generally, I think I was going through a period of time in my life where I was really trying as much as possible to live and embody and practice these sort of various ethical ideals that I had. And so in addition to boycotting eating meat, I was also boycotting, say, buying clothes from certain sources that I knew were using factory child labor overseas. And I was also really sort of boycotting a feminine ideal, I think. I was trying as much as possible to avoid becoming, you know, sort of overly domesticated. I wanted to be an independent career woman. And so I really sort of took upon myself to develop this look of a political radical. So I shaved my head. I had a couple of lip piercings at the time. I was really trying, like I said, to look the part of the progressive that I really wanted to be and to live.
And how were relations with your family when you took your radical vegetarian self home for Christmas, for example?
Well, they didn't quite know what to do with me. I think, in general, my family was more confused by all of this than anything else. And now, looking back on it, I can understand why. I think so much of my transformation was about the optics of it, was about how I looked rather than really what I was doing. But my family was very supportive, generally, of my transition to vegetarianism. Though they were confused by it and they didn't really understand why I wanted to do it, my mother really went out of her way to cook for me as a vegetarian, even going so far as to make me a homemade polenta roast for my first Thanksgiving.
Wow.
As a vegetarian.
So there's a fun passage in here on how it should have worked when you became a vegetarian. Walk us through what you think should have happened and what actually did.
Sure. I really had this idea that being a vegetarian was going to mean that I just automatically ate a healthier, more environmentally friendly diet, that I was more in touch with nature. I thought that I would eat, you know, all fresh vegetables, all whole foods, that I would be incredibly fit, that my body would be sort of working in its peak sort of physical capacity. But what I discovered was that it's actually remarkably easy to be a vegetarian in modern America and not eat that many vegetables. As I said earlier, I was becoming a vegetarian while still eating at my college dining hall, and then moving out on my own after college, also as a vegetarian, I was buying and shopping and cooking and eating like most college students and college graduates do. I was eating cheap, prepackaged, easy-to-make food. I was eating a lot of ramen noodles, boxed macaroni and cheese, pasta, and frozen foods, and those sorts of things, all of which were vegetarian, so I wasn't eating meat, but I really wasn't eating the kind of healthy, eco-friendly diet that I had expected to.
Marissa Landrigan is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food. So how was your health? I mean, when you were talking about just thinking that your body would be at its peak performance, but how did you really feel when you were eating some of this prepackaged yet meatless stuff?
Absolutely awful. Some of my worst years, truly health-wise, were during the years that I was a vegetarian. I unsurprisingly gained a pretty significant amount of weight because I was eating so many more starches and carbohydrates to sort of fill in the gap that meat had left behind, and unfortunately really not filling that gap in my plate in with more produce.
You do write in the book about the fact that these practices continued after college, and you were eating some fairly sketchy things out of the microwave as an intern in Washington, D.C. But then you left Washington for Bozeman, Montana. Why?
Well, at the time, I, again, was sort of trying to live my ideals, and I thought I was working in Washington, D.C. at a nonprofit, and I wanted to sort of be, a progressive, an activist. And while I was living and working in D.C., I felt like I was sort of working within the existing political system, and I decided that I wanted to sort of work outside of the system as more of a creative writer and try to influence change from the outside. And, of course, it didn't hurt that my college boyfriend had moved to Bozeman, Montana as well.
Ah, that really does help, yeah. There's a great story here about telling a coworker at a retail store in Bozeman, Montana, that you were a vegetarian. What transpired there?
Well, the very first thing that she said to me, and she was just a high schooler, a teenager who was working at the store with me, and I said that I was a vegetarian, and she said, "Oh, I don't think we can be friends." And it sounded really harsh at the time, but what she meant was that eating meat, and specifically hunting and killing her own meat, was such an integral part of her life and her community and her family that she didn't really know what to make of someone who didn't participate in that system.
How big is hunting culture there? She was just sort of a tip of an iceberg, wasn't she?
Yes, absolutely. Hunting is really a big part of the culture in Montana and most of the West and in many other sort of rural places. And not only is hunting really crucial, but hunting specifically for meat to eat and to consume was a really big part of the culture. Most of the people I know who were hunters were not just sport hunters, but were really people who hunted deer and elk and used that meat to feed their families through the winter. They found it, you know, a very affordable way to get meat, and also a way that to many of them was really in keeping with the natural ecosystem, where the deer populations, of course, were booming as, you know, more and more predators have left the West.
Did your curiosity extend to wanting to go along on hunts with some of the folks you knew in Bozeman?
You know, it did not at the time, though, of course, I did do something like that much, much later in my journey. But at the time, I was still very much trying to avoid seeing the dead animal as the precursor to a meal. And so really, I found it almost as horrifying as I found the PETA video, despite the fact that there really were very different motivations going on there.
We're talking to Marissa Landrigan about her book, The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food, a chance for all of us to pause and reflect on the choices we make in what we choose to eat and who that affects, whether it's other creatures or even the humans who have to process the food for us. Join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The idea of killing what you eat yourself instead of letting someone else do it had been in your head since college. I mean, and it sounds like it stuck with you for quite a while. Had it taken any form by the time you were in Bozeman or leaving Bozeman?
You know, it really was something that had stuck in my head, and it was initially a classmate of mine in response to that PETA video who said that he thought that it was sort of ethically wrong to outsource that killing, essentially, to eat meat without being willing to face the fact that it meant, you know, an animal had died for that. And because I felt at the time that I wasn't able to face that, I thought that I should just avoid eating meat. When I lived in Montana, I really saw that there were plenty of people who were very comfortable acknowledging and embracing that fact, and even, of course, going so far as to do the killing themselves. And it began to sort of complicate my thinking to see how many people were taking home deer and really doing the work of dismantling it and saving it and preserving that meat so that they could feed their families.
Did you see something, I don't know, what was the general impression you were left with? Was there some admiration that began to crop up in your mind for hunters?
There really was. It seemed to be a very sort of crucial and almost ritualistic thing, and it actually really reminded me quite a bit of my family's relationships with food. Though we, of course, were not hunting and not practicing the same rituals, I really saw families who saw the act of hunting and dismantling an animal as a sort of family food ritual, as a way to come together and connect through the preparation of their food. And that really reminded me a lot of my family's large-scale, you know, day-long pasta-making sessions, a ritual that we all engaged in to share our food with each other.
When I think about living in a place where somebody said, I don't know if I can be friends with you because you're a vegetarian, I have to ask what it was like to try to eat vegetarian in restaurants around Bozeman, Montana.
It was not the easiest thing at the time, though again, some of that was a result of the choices that I made as a rather picky vegetarian. But I was eating a lot of cheese pizzas around that period of time, and in some cases there were certainly a few restaurants that I went to in the more rural parts of the state where my options were pretty much just a side salad or a baked potato.
Wow, that was it, huh?
That was about as far as it ever went.
All right, so from Montana, moved to Southern California and some freelance writing, and talk about the assignment to write about the Ventura Coast Keeper.
Yes, so I was given an assignment to do an interview with a man named Mati Waya, who had just been appointed to the network of National Coast Keepers, which is a national network of volunteers who are engaged in protecting the ecosystems of their local waterways. And so I was interviewing Mati Waya, who was the local coast keeper for the city of Ventura. And one of the first things that he told me about were some of the complications that came from trying to protect and preserve the waterways in Southern California. And he was talking about, for instance, all the runoff of toxic chemicals from the agricultural fields of Southern California. And I was just shocked because I had thought of Southern California as a sort of food paradise where there was lots of fresh and healthy produce, and I never had realized the environmental impact that that agriculture had.
It sounds like this really lit a bit of a fire under you.
Absolutely. I decided that I should learn more about this because I was discovering that part of my vegetarian diet was also contributing to some environmental destruction. And so I came back home from the interview and I hopped on the internet and I started researching and almost immediately discovered that this was actually pretty well-known information, that it was just new to me, not actually new. There had been many, many investigative pieces done already on the sort of toxic runoff from the massive large-scale agriculture in Southern California.
I have an image of you staying up late into the night finding out new things about how food is supplied in this country. Was it something like that?
Yes, absolutely. Really sort of going down a Google rabbit hole, if you will, and discovering, much to my dismay, that my vegetarian diet was not as healthy or eco-friendly as I had thought it might be.
So examples, what were some of the things that really blew your mind as you read further?
Well, specifically, I learned a lot about the impact that these toxic chemicals have on farm workers. So the toxic chemicals that are used in agriculture are used as pesticides or herbicides to protect the crops that are grown. But these are very unhealthy chemicals for plant life, animal life, and for human life. In fact, farm workers have the highest rates of birth defects, skin disorders, cancer and toxic chemical injuries of almost any job in the United States because they are so incredibly exposed to all of these toxic chemicals. And of course, that means that many of the people who work on farms producing these great, fresh, healthy vegetables are having some enormous suffering as a result of that. And of course, most of that exposure happens to undocumented migrant workers who make up the majority of farm workers in the United States, which means that they have no legal rights and no real recourse to protect themselves from this kind of toxic exposure.
Marissa Landrigan's our guest on The Exchange. Her book is The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat. So you're getting to a point then when you're realizing, wait a minute, so I haven't been eating meat because I wanted to be kind to animals, but the fact is that even being a vegetarian, you could be contributing to processes that are not terribly kind to people.
Yes, absolutely. And I found that deeply troubling that years before I had discovered how inhumane this factory farm system could be to animals, but that it had taken me another 5 years or so as a vegetarian before I discovered how inhumane the process could be to my fellow humans.
Did that result in changes in your behavior and the things you began to buy right on the spot?
It certainly made me much more interested specifically in organic farming because I thought to myself, well, if I can avoid those toxic chemicals by supporting organic farms, then I can, again, avoid sort of having that kind of suffering as part of my dietary choices as well.
So every place you go in this book, including a trip with your mother to Ghana in Africa, you observe the relationship with food. And give us a sense of how different the food culture was there.
Well, in Ghana, animal protein was very rare, very hard to come by, and very crucial to most people's diets because it was such a limited resource. It was really one of the only sources they had for protein. So whereas in the United States and in other more developed countries, we can, as vegetarians, substitute other kinds of food for animal protein and still get our nutritional needs met. In a country like Ghana, that's very difficult. For instance, we can oftentimes replace animal protein with things like leafy greens, for instance, which have a lot of protein in them. But in Ghana, leafy greens don't grow. They don't have a climate that supports that kind of produce. For the most part, they can grow staple crops and starches, things like cassava or yam, which are, of course, very, you know, important complex carbohydrates, but are not going to give them the kinds of protein they need. And so the very rare, very small amounts of animal protein that they have access to are really very crucial for their nutritional needs.
So this must have been a real clue to the idea of eating locally, that that in a world where you don't have planes and ships that can move huge amounts of food from place to place, that if you just eat the stuff nearby, you're going to be eating very different things.
Yes, absolutely. And it really opened my eyes to the idea that being able to choose to be a vegetarian was really a privilege, and that not everyone has access to the kinds of resources that allow them to make that kind of a dietary choice.
Oh, in the sense that it's easier to be a vegetarian, for example, in the United States than it would be in a place like Ghana?
Absolutely. When you have access, as you said, to all those planes and ships and all of that, the varied produce that we get when we go to the grocery store. And they really had to make a diet that worked for them nutritionally with what they had local and immediate access to.
Marissa Landrigan is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food. Maybe you have your own ideas about what makes their choices in food ethical or not, or have some questions for Marissa about the many things she found out. This is a lot of years of research represented in this book. Feel free to join us on the exchange when we come back from the break. Marissa Landrigan and you back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Marissa Landrigan, who is an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh-Johnstown, where she teaches writing. Her essays have been published in the likes of The Atlantic and Salon, and she gives us an extended essay in thinking about food and the ethics of what we put on our forks, on our plates, in our bellies. Her book is called The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat. She was a vegetarian, no longer claims that title. A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food is the subtitle of the book, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your own observations about thoughts you've had about stuff you put on your plate, on your fork, in your belly. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Just a side moment here. We were just talking about your trip to Ghana with your mother and the realization that you eat what is nearby, particularly in parts of the world that aren't as wealthy as this one, where you can't just get stuff off the shelf that came from thousands of miles away. But you do come several times in the book back to a different concept, which is the human gathering over food. I mean, what's on the table aside, how universal did you find that to be?
Oh, I think that this is one of the most universal sort of traits of humanity, the way that we all come together around food. Over the course of researching and writing this book and thinking about it, I found that I could connect to almost anyone with a discussion about food. Whatever we eat, however we eat, however we get our food, and whatever our ethics are, it's of course something that we all share. And I really found that so many people have such great and vivid memories when it comes to sharing meals and cooking with other people.
Did you find a lot of people your own age had similar stories? Well, not just your own age, any age really, about the kinds of rituals in the kitchen that your family had?
You know, it was interesting to discover how many people had rituals and how much variation there was in those rituals. There were a lot of people who couldn't believe that my family made our own ravioli and tortellini, but who had rituals that I couldn't believe. For example, when I met the man who is now my husband, he grew up on a farm, and I was so thrilled to discover the ways in which his family sort of communed around their food. For instance, making entire meals out of the vegetables that they were able to just bring in from the garden. Though they thought it was amazing that we made our own ravioli, I thought it was pretty amazing that they grew their own corn outside.
Was this a fairly ethical farm, I hope?
It was, absolutely. Definitely people who are great stewards of the land, and the land and the farm in their case has been in their family for more than 150 years, and so they take a responsibility to that very seriously.
You did go to a graduate school in Iowa, and I wondered what kind of preconceived notions of food production you had there in the middle of America in a state that elected a senator who spoke of castrating hogs.
Absolutely. I really expected, I knew that moving to Iowa was sort of going to be moving into the belly of the beast of industrial agriculture, so to speak. One of the hearts of industrial agriculture, really in deep in cattle country, there were factories from Tyson and Smithfield, meat producers, right nearby where I went to graduate school, and just miles and miles and miles of corn and soybeans everywhere. You sort of could see from miles around. So I really went into it expecting that it was going to be largely an industrial agricultural landscape, and a pretty sort of narrow one at that.
And what did you find, though?
Well, I did find all of that, but I also found a whole network of local, small-scale, sustainable farmers who were doing really innovative farming practices. There was a great farmers market community in the town where I went to graduate school. Lots of community-supported agriculture programs and buy-in clubs that provided access to sustainable meat products, even sustainable seafood that was sort of shipped in as part of this buy-in club. So I discovered that while there was a lot of industrial agriculture in the Midwest, there were also a lot of people, like my husband's family, who had had farms in their families for centuries, who felt a great deal of responsibility to the land and to the food that they were producing for people on that land.
And is their farm organic or attempting to be anyway?
Absolutely. Most of them were either certified organic or were essentially engaged in organic practices, though they couldn't necessarily afford the certification process, something that's very time-consuming and very expensive for a small-scale farm.
I've had this chat before with farmers. The fellow from Polyface Farm in Virginia, whose name escapes me at the moment, talks about the fact that he actually goes beyond what the state of Virginia identifies as organic, and he's not willing to spend the money to get their certification.
Yes, absolutely. And there's such a huge amount of variation, too, as well with the organic certification. There are state-level and federal-level certifications, and both have different sets of standards. And so most of the farmers that I met were running such small-scale farms that it was simply easier for them to go to the market and explain to people what they did and how they raised their animals, or to invite people out to the farm to take a look for themselves at the kinds of practices they employed in growing their food.
Joel Salatin, come to think of it, was the name I was grasping for, and he is mentioned in Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma. Did you run across Michael Pollan personally in the process of preparing this book? It seems like everybody needs to pass by the feet of the master.
It is. It's really a sort of a rite of passage for anyone who's trying to learn more about their food. And I did. Actually, reading The Omnivore's Dilemma while I was in graduate school was really transformative for me. In fact, the first section of that book, where Pollan specifically is looking at corn, actually begins in the town where I went to graduate school, Ames, Iowa. And so I felt an immediate connection to it. And he was really sort of painting a picture of that industrial agricultural landscape and demonstrating the ways in which that industrial agriculture really sort of infects most of the food that we eat in the United States, even vegetarian products and non-meat products.
You said infects. Was that term deliberate? Did you mean affects or did you mean infects?
Yes, I think it is really a sort of like an infection, in that the industrial agricultural system has just sort of transformed the way that we grow, the way that we eat, and even the way that we think about food.
So for you personally, we haven't established yet if there was a particular moment when you said, that's it, I'm going back to eating meat, or if it was a bit more of a gradual process, like a little bit of meat here, then a little bit of meat. Okay, fine, it's back in my diet now.
It was actually a very conscious decision, definitely a moment that I decided, okay, I'm going to try this again. And it was really a result of meeting these farmers at my local market in Iowa that I decided to do so. Because initially I had become a vegetarian to boycott the industrial system of producing meat and all of its inhumanity and environmental destruction. And I saw in Iowa people who were producing meat in a completely different way, who were engaged in these really biodynamic farming practices where raising livestock animals was an integral part of a holistic system of growing food. And I thought it made more sense to support or buy into that system, the small scale, the local, the sustainable, rather than just boycott all meat altogether. And so I did buy a couple of chicken breasts from one of those local farmers, and I sat down to have my first meal with chicken in it after about 7 years as a vegetarian.
When you go out to eat, for example, though, how careful are you? And do you ask the questions like they made fun of in Portlandia? You know, what was the chicken's name? That sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of my favorite episodes of Portlandia. I share that all the time with my friends. You know, there's one of the things about eating ethically is I think that you're always sort of making some trade-offs. So one of the things that I've discovered is that the hard truth about eating as a human is that most of our dietary choices contribute in some way to some form of suffering. And so I think in many cases you have to make the best decision with what's available to you. So when I go out to eat at restaurants, I sort of scope out the landscape, if you will, and decide what kind of a place I'm at and what kinds of choices I should make. If I'm at a place that clearly has locally sourced food, that, you know, there are all these places now that right on their menu will tell you what farms the animals have come from and all that, then I'm comfortable eating a meat entree, for instance. But if I'm at more of a chain restaurant or a fast food restaurant or something along those lines, I'm more likely to sort of try and stick with the vegetarian option because I think it's a safe bet that those kinds of companies are more likely to be buying industrially produced meat.
It seems like over the course of this odyssey that you did find the food system responding to the kinds of concerns that you were raising, though. I mean, the fact is that a fair number of restaurants now advertise that they have their own farms nearby, that they are trying to source more things locally. There's more things on the menu that indicate these came from just a few miles away.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, and our great capitalist system, it's the almighty dollar that's doing it. I think more and more people are interested in where their food comes from and the conditions in which the animals they eat are raised. And I think we're seeing the industry really respond to that. There are lots more places that have vegetarian or even vegan options on their menu, and lots of places that really take pride in sort of where they source their food from locally.
Let's return to the first thing we talked about and the first thing you write about in the book, which is your visit to a slaughterhouse from a small-scale operation. So this is a place where they actually knew the animals. The animals came through one at a time. But the way in which you really went for the blood and guts of this, was this a bit of a test for yourself or just to make sure that you fully understood where your meat was coming from?
Was a sort of a test and a willingness to embrace understanding where my meat came from, because that was really the root of my decision to become a vegetarian. Was when I saw where my food came from, I couldn't stomach it. And so I knew if I was going to go back to eating meat, I had to sort of take on the responsibility of looking at the source of my food and really seeing where it came from and how it was raised, because that was the thing that initially I was trying to avoid. And so gradually, step by step, I sort of took on these challenges to put myself closer and closer to the moment of actually watching an animal die so that I could eventually eat it.
And did your responses surprise you at all?
They absolutely did in almost every case. Initially, there was sort of an ick factor to be overcome, for sure. The first time, for instance, that I dismantled a whole chicken, that I actually sort of took a whole chicken and skinned it and cut it up into its component parts and deboned it, that was really something I had to work through a little bit. But afterwards, I discovered that I really enjoyed eating that chicken because I felt a much more intimate connection to it than I was used to feeling with my food.
Did it actually taste a little different for?
I think that it actually did. I think that it tasted a little bit better, though whether that's because I had handled it myself or because I was buying local and cage-free pasture-raised chicken is up for debate.
So give us a sense of what people can do with the information they get from you, particularly if they live in the burbs like you did growing up and maybe don't have farms nearby, that sort of thing, and are looking for places they want to do good, they want to be ethical, they want to eat local, but are finding some obstacles to that.
Well, I think absolutely the easiest thing to do and the easiest change to make is to start shopping and eating locally. And I think that most people would be surprised to discover how accessible local food often is. Even the suburbs now mostly have farmers markets. My parents, my hometown where I grew up, where my parents still live, has multiple farmers markets now, things that were absolutely not there when I was growing up in the suburbs. And so there are, of course, farmers markets and community-supported agriculture programs, but even just shopping at locally owned butcher shops or grocers can often be a good way to sort of get closer to the source of your food. Because those grocers, those shop owners are much more likely to know the people in the area who are producing food. And I think it's also important, as much as possible, to sort of familiarize yourself with some of the various labels at the grocery store. If you do most of your shopping at a chain grocery store, for instance, rather than a locally owned grocery store, it's good to know the difference between a label that says grass-fed beef, for instance, and one that simply says all natural beef, and to know that those two things are not the same and that one is more likely to give you a better product than the other.
All right, so the all-natural could actually be eating all-natural corn or something, right?
Right, exactly. All-natural is a completely unregulated label, so it can really mean just about whatever the company wants it to mean.
Do you find that eating ethically does cost more than certainly than the microwave vegetarian meals you had in college and afterward?
I think that in general, eating ethically does, and I think this is really a marker of our industrial food system and the things that we've sort of historically chosen to support and to subsidize in the United States specifically. In fact, a recent study from the Harvard School for Public Health found that just eating a diet made up primarily of produce actually cost more. So when you add in grass-fed and organic, there is an added price tag, but I think there are ways to cope with that.
All right, so but you expect the industrial system to deliver things that are mass-produced a little more cheaply, and so if you want to eat ethically, it probably will cost you a bit more. The book is called The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food, a memoir from Marissa Landrigan, who joined us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Marissa, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.